Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we're going to bring you, or I should say, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It's Monday, October 14th, 2019. Good afternoon, Dave.
Here.
Are you there?
Yep.
We couldn't hear you.
Yeah, I think you dropped me for somehow. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, don't tell me it's going to be one of these days.
Are we connected to Todd?
Yes, we are.
Todd?
Yes, we're live.
Oh, we're live? Okay.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Good. Oh, hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, yes. We didn't hear the music, did you?
No.
All righty. But let's go ahead and as we work these little technical issues, maybe we can turn up the music a little bit so we can hear going into the break. We have some technical difficulties, but we are live. Can you tell that, folks? We're live. And there isn't anything like doing live radio, right, Dave?
Indeed.
And it is October 14th. It's Columbus Day. It's 2019. I'm just going to go on because I'm just sort of like stuttering all over the place here, ladies and gentlemen. But let's go ahead and get to the gold and silver pricing today. And I was a little sidetracked doing some trades right before coming onto the program. So let me get my things together. Gold today was up $14.93. Up $2.90, $14.92, up $2.90. Silver was up 10 cents today at $17.71. Platinum was down 3 at $896. Palladium was up 6 at $17.13. The USDX today was up 20.20, 98.51. Crude oil was down 125 at $53.45. And the paper markets today, they were down very early in trade. The Dow was, down 30 points, no big deal, 26,786. The NASDAQ was down 8,048. The S&P was down 4 at 2,966. I guess the only market that was closed today was the bond market. Well, there might have been some other little markets closed, but mainly it was the bond market, I believe, Dave. Japan was stronger. And I'll tell you what, Japan got hit really hard with a storm. Quite a few deaths. I mean, we know we have James Corbett. We'll talk about that, see if he was affected at all. And I also have some clients. They were expected to come home from Japan on Sunday, yesterday, but that storm went through. So I'm kind of anxious to see if they made it out. There was like 25 or 35 deaths or something like that. And pretty strong storm that got very little attention in the media. But other than that, it was sort of a quiet day in the markets. And, of course, Dave, I think everyone was still a little focused on, this trade agreement. China said it wants to have additional trade talks before signing what Donald Trump has characterized Friday as a very substantial phase one deal. So it's still not clear if the additional talks will take place in Beijing or Washington. However, as part of phase one, China would buy between $40 billion and $50 billion in U.S. agricultural products. You know, I was thinking about that, Dave. Over the past year, we have had commitments from China to buy $1 trillion into the markets. Then they were talking about, $70 and $80 billion into agricultural products. And now we're down to $40 billion and $50 billion in agricultural products. So I don't know if those other numbers still apply, if they were just fake news. I don't know what it was. But
Neither. I think, they were just numbers that were out there. But I think China's looking for probably a more substantial agreement than, this supposedly phase one deal that is in the offing.
You know, I guess they also agreed to address the intellectual property concerns that were raised by the U.S. In return, the U.S. agreed to hold off on the tariff hike that was scheduled for this week.
Yeah, Trump said that the phase one deal was a success, but China's characterization of the outcome was far more circumspect. Their state media said that both sides made substantial progress, but they didn't use the word deal when describing the outcome. Investors are having some second thoughts about this quote-unquote agreement, a number of analysts said today. Even though there was a breakdown in the talks, nothing was a breakthrough in the talks, excuse me, nothing was signed, one of them said. Now, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said this morning that while both sides made substantial progress last week, the agreement is still, in his words, subject to documentation. He also said a December tariff hike on Chinese products would go through if a deal is not signed off on by then. As Melody mentioned, gold held steady today as a lack of clarity on trade pushed investors back to safe havens.
You know, a lot of the market strategists are saying that we shouldn't get too overexcited about what's happening now. Nothing has dramatically changed, and we should all be a little cautious now to conclude that things are heading in the right direction. And, there's also chief analysis, Carlo DeCasso, active trades head from a technical point of view, and he's talking about gold. Gold prices are still in a lateral mode with the first resistance place at 1500, followed by another key level at 1515. And we also, everyone's kind of looking forward to a summit between the European Union and the UK in Brussels on Thursday and Friday. However, a deal to smooth Britain's departure from the EU hung in the balance after the diplomats indicated that the bloc wanted more concessions, of course, from Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, and said a full agreement that also was unlikely this week.
Yeah, well, on another note, the damage is done, Melody. That's the message from 57 fund managers who participated in Bank of America's latest rates and currency sentiment survey, which was conducted last week. Respondents from the U.S., the U.K., Europe, and Asia, who together control more than $800 billion in assets under management, were the ones who participated. Asked to choose from a variety of statements regarding the prospects for the global economy, 55% chose this one. The global uncertainty shock has been so persistent that lasting damage has been done and policy action will be too little, too late. That's pretty interesting. Another 22% agreed that Fed policy will continue to shield the U.S., resulting in a persistent divergence between the U.S. and global economies. And only 9% agreed that activity should rebound strongly as the U.S.-China deal is signed and monetary policy receives support from fiscal policy.
You know, given that economic expectations have a rather pernicious habit of becoming self-fulfilling, you know, these types of survey results are disconcerting. In keeping with their expectations, participants in the survey cited a fundamental reassessment of global growth and inflation prospects. When asked what's likely behind the plunge in bond yields in 2019, so you have this rather dull assessment is in keeping with the data, which show that despite some lingering resilience in the United States, the global economy continues to decelerate along with global trade. And you know, as we reported before, or as the IMF, or we reported in the July update, the IMF slashed its outlook for global growth for the fourth time in 9 months. And the fund sees the global economy expanding 3.2% in 2019, down from 3.3% in April and 3.5% in January. And even the outlook for 2020 was cut to 3.5% from 3.6% 3 months previously.
Well, that 3.5 could end up being quite optimistic.
Yes.
If we see things continuing on their current path. Now, similarly, the OECD recently cut their forecast for growth. In a September update, that organization said the global economy will expand just 2.9% this year and 3% next. That was the weakest annual growth rate since the financial crisis. The OEC warned that escalating trade conflicts are taking an increasing toll on confidence and investment, adding to policy uncertainty, aggravating risks in financial markets, and endangering already weak growth prospects worldwide. Now, no matter what happens over the next few months, it's going to take more than a vague verbal agreement between the U.S. and China and an averted worst-case scenario in the UK on Brexit to shake that long-term resolve of the deflation camp. Some analysts believe at this juncture, just about the only thing that can change the game overnight would be a concerted fiscal stimulus push from Germany, China, or both. Well, we shall see, Melody.
You know, we're going to switch the tune here. We're going to talk a little bit about the Syrian army is joining the Kurds. And so there were hours after reaching an agreement with Kurdish forces, the Syrian army entered Tel Tamer. This is a key town near the Turkish border. And, of course, this is a significant shift in the power dynamic. We have the return of government forces to northeastern Syria, and not only deals a blow to Kurdish-led forces that were supported by the U.S., but also signals a major shift in Syria's eight-year war. And the Syrian government had been almost entirely absent from the northeast since it withdrew or was chased out by the armed rebels. Now, there's just so much in here. I'm not all, you know, the devil's in the details, and there's a lot of details here, but it gets confusing on how, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is the Kurdish-led militia, it worked with the U.S., soon became the region's overarching political force. Can you do a better job? This is really a guy's thing. It's not my thing. Can you do a little bit better job than I am doing?
Oh, no. I think what you said, it is what it is. The Syrian Kurds didn't declare Bashar Assad's government an enemy. Assad still distrusted their efforts to establish self-rule, and he's vowed to retake all of Syria's territory, a good chunk, in the northeast of which has been occupied by the Kurds, again, under the Syrian Democratic Forces and some others, which we'll talk about later on in the program if this new news comes in. But Assad had no way to do that, that is, to retake the northeast, especially with American troops remaining in that area. The U.S. President Trump's decision last week to remove those troops out of the way of a Turkish incursion has given Assad that opening, and his forces apparently have begun to fill it today. Now that city that Melody mentioned, Tel Tamer, is a strategic crossroads that connects northeastern Syria with the country's northern hub, which is Aleppo, which has been in the news a lot over the last 2 years, 20 miles from Ras al Ain, the center of the Turkish assault right now. If Syrian forces can reach the Turkish border to the north and the Iraqi border to the east, it'd be a major breakthrough, they're saying, in Assad's quest to reestablish his control over the entire country. Now, one major Kurdish official told the Syrian forces to stay away and said the Kurds will fight alone in one part of the border where the Turkish forces have already established a strong presence. He added that Kurdish authorities will also remain in charge of the administration and policing of that region, but Syrian officials haven't confirmed those details. Now, on an important and related note, foreign ministers from all 28 EU member states agreed unanimously today to stop selling arms to Turkey. It's the first time the bloc reached such a decision about a fellow NATO ally. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. I get a little bit of mixed thoughts about over there. There was really a good article, and it was odd for some reason. It's been a while since I'd been to the website antiwar.com, and there was a brief article about what's going on, and it was in relationship to bringing our troops home and so forth, and why are we there, and blah blah blah. And it was really interesting, and maybe we'll post it in the newsletter. I'm not sure yet. We'll get it included this week, but maybe next week. But it makes you think, and to me, this is what information is all about. It should make you think that you shouldn't follow. You got to do some of your own critical thinking, and to get a better understanding of, what is right, what is wrong, how we got there, and should we be there. But let's go on and talk a little bit about the millennial savings, Dave.
Back to finance, ladies and gentlemen. Millennials, the young ones, saving their money could be to blame for the sluggish economy. It's according to the investment company Raymond James. Now, according to the St. Louis Fed, the U.S. personal savings rate has increased from 5.7% in 1996 to 8.1% this year. And that rate, according to Raymond James, has had disinflationary impact, driving the relatively slow growth and low inflation in the economy. They say causing incentives for excess supply and a disinflation-deflation bias in the global economy. Now, as listeners know, a slowdown in spending hurts businesses, which in turn hurts the economy. That in turn leads to slower growth, deflationary biases in price, excess supply, and increasing debt from the supply side attempts to improve the situation because the savings rate is going higher. People aren't spending, they're saving, or at least the millennials are, according to this study. Millennials who came of age during the Great Recession and were born between 1981 and 1996 started to save more following the financial crisis. The report said the U.S. consumer has had enough, so they're saving instead of purchasing like the last generation, and that's limiting demand growth.
I think there's something else that we could add to that as far as why they are saving. I mean, we read about it all the time, how many of them are still at home.
Yeah.
And they don't have the expenses. And we're heading into a break, and we'll just add that, end that when we come back. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. It's a little of, I guess it's because it's Columbus Day, and yes, even though the bond, it was really only the bond market that was closed today, it's just sort of like a, it feels like a holiday today, Dave. Don't know why. But it just feels like one. So whenever the banks or the post offices are closed, I don't know if federal governments are closed. Offices,
yes.
Are closed?
Yep, they are.
Well, if they get a holiday, then we should get a holiday.
But, I couldn't agree more.
There you go. So we're taking these articles today with a little bit of a grain of salt today. But one thing I wanted to say about the millennials, about their savings rate is increasing is they're all living at home, so they don't have any extra expenses, so they can save more so than probably most earlier generations.
I mean, my daughter has probably five times more saved than I ever did at her young age.
Yeah.
She lives at home.
but I mean, it's a good thing, but it gives reason why the savings are increasing. It's not because of higher wages. It's not because of, it's a great habit, don't get me wrong. It's a very great long-term habit that they are acquiring, but it isn't because of higher incomes.
Well, that's an important point to make.
So moving on along, the Fed, Minneapolis Fed President, Neil Kashkari has told Fox Business News that the economic backdrop may lead him to support another rate cut. He says on Friday, this was him speaking on Friday, he thinks that the data is a little bit mixed. He thinks we should be providing some support to the economy, and he thinks that rates are roughly around neutral.
Mm-hmm.
He says he thinks he's going to be in favor of another rate cut. How many more we have to go? It'll depend on the data. Oh, you've heard that for how many years from little Miss Janet Yellen? Data dependent. It's all data dependent. That's the calming words for the stock market. But the Fed is still widely expected to cut rates at the end of this month. And the September meeting minutes that was released shows a clear divide over whether or not to cut rates in the near term. Kashkari, he's not a voting member of the Fed this year, but participates in meetings that does concern policy. And
Melody, I believe now that there is a good chance that when the recession does officially hit, and it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, I think there's now a very good chance that interest rates will be at zero,
mm-hmm.
which means that real interest rates will be in negative territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not good in terms of the way we've, you know, been finding our way out of recent recessions. What it also means is that to the extent that's the case, or even now, you know, after another 0.25% reduction, be down between 1.5% and 1.75%, that can only mean bad news for the federal debt, which on a gross basis, as we know, is already over 100% of GDP. You know, if, the recession is mild, well, maybe not so big or as big a problem. But all signs are leading toward a recession that's not so mild. And that means there's going to be a lot of pressure on Congress and the White House to get us out of that mess with, more spending, whether that's, the impetus for this $1 trillion+ infrastructure plan that's been talked about for a couple of years or, and or other projects. Well, that remains to be seen. But in any event, we're not in a very good place. And yet, folks like Kashkari, who says the U.S. consumer is still very strong, and certainly by these consumer sentiment surveys, that's true. Well, in a lot of other senses, it's not. But he says most Americans have jobs. Well, that's debatable, too. John Williams of Shadow Stats says, the unemployment rate isn't 3.6%. It's closer to 20. And even if you don't believe him, you take the government's rate counting, discouraged and folks who've just plain stopped looking for jobs, and it's around 7. And in any event, their wages are growing, more and more slowly. So any event, Kashkari says, consumers represent 70% of the economy, so perhaps it's not as bad as, people like us are making it out to be. Melody, it sounded like you wanted to say something.
Well, when we talk about the consumer, the consumer is strong, what's it based on? The majority of that is based on the stock market, because that's the retirement accounts, the pension plans. And I mean, how else do they determine what a strong consumer is? By jobs? Well, you'd explain that. They're fudging there. So just how really strong, and that's, we have a strong consumer as long as everything remains the same, that there's no blips. But you know what? When you mentioned that about negative rates, the real rate being negative, we look to other countries that have been in the negative territory. They seem to be doing, there's damage being done that no one talks about, but you haven't had any big disconnects or crashes in their stock markets and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that's overseas. We're the only ones. Now, once we get to those rates, where is the confidence to buy our debt so that we can invest the trillions of dollars that's needed for the infrastructure?
Yeah. Yeah, excellent point.
So it's one thing to have Japan in negative rates. It's something else to have the European Central Bank in negative rates. But it's something totally different to have the United States in negative rates. If we are the engine,
the leading indicator of leading indicators.
Right. And we get to negative, it's frightening, Dave, that they will pull out all stops just to keep this going.
Well, even Kashkari says, businesses seem to be pulling back. They seem to be nervous. Well, duh. he says, we've heard they're nervous about the trade war. For 2 years, investment seems to be slowing. Well, yeah, the tax cuts didn't do anything. They, took all that extra money and buy back their stocks. But to his credit, I guess, he also said that he's had it with the hubris and stupidity of Wall Street bankers. Hear, hear. He said, quote, honestly, my patience for these market opinions is basically gone. So, where everything like that leads us, well, we'll find out again in a little over 2 weeks when the Open Market Committee meets at the end of the month.
And so they will do anything and everything to keep that, that the stock market is the economy.
Yeah, what a joke.
And, yeah, it really is. And I don't know. We just keep our fingers crossed. And, something no one's talking about, except, you know, you wrote about it. We mentioned it briefly here on this program, where the federal government's fiscal year 2020 began in zealous earnest on October 1st. Congress didn't complete action on appropriations to all federal agencies before fiscal year 2019. That ended on September 30th. So the House passed a continuing resolution a few weeks ago that funds the government through November 21st. The Senate passed the CR a week later, and of course it was signed by President Trump the next day. Little fanfare, ladies and gentlemen. They don't want to talk about this. Without the passage of the remaining appropriations, all of them, not just one or two, all of them don't want to talk about this. Without the passage of the remaining appropriation bills or enactment of another CR by November 21st, the government will enter another partial shutdown starting the next day. The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget expects the House and Senate to use the next few weeks to continue negotiations on full appropriations for the rest of the fiscal year 2020. And you know what, Dave? We've gotten so used to this. Nobody cares. Yet.
Yeah, they will. They will eventually. You know, Congress enacted legislation in August to raise the discretionary spending caps, which actually had impeded work on the FY 2020 appropriations earlier this year. Congress began appropriations work for the new fiscal year back in March and started to release individual appropriation bills in May. A few of them have been passed. In fact, I think, you know, well, what are there? There are at least four that haven't been. Discretionary spending had been scheduled to return to lower, quote, sequester level caps in 2020, representing a 10% decrease from last year's level. That cast uncertainty over the entire appropriations process until Congress enacted the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2019 in early August. And that act waived the across-the-board sequester cuts. You know, although Congress is supposed to complete a budget resolution, you know, each year to lay out fiscal principles and the blueprint, set appropriations levels, lawmakers didn't adopt one again for 2020.
And, you know, and this is no wonder they have, what, a 2% approval rating or whatever it might be. They don't do anything. They do absolutely nothing. It's amazing. The House used a procedure that's known as deeming. Deeming. And that permits the House Appropriation Committee to begin its work. To begin it? Assuming that increased spending caps were continued with inflation before Congress formally changed those caps through enactment of this new law. And if you're confused, don't worry. I'll bet you a lot of members of Congress, and perhaps even the president, is too. So we're going to continue to track the appropriations bills as they move from committee to the House and the Senate floor and onto the president's desk. And we'll let you know where things, particularly proposed new policy and projected debt levels, stand. And it really is amazing, Dave, that it just doesn't seem to matter anymore. You know, and our weekly American Survival newsletter is going to be published after today's program. And this week's edition includes an article on the trustworthiness of economists by Dave's weekly insights from Doug Nolan. And he had another great article in there. And also from Wendy Wilson's, we'll have her article in there. So you can subscribe to our free blog and newsletter by going to dgscoins.com. Or you can also go to our Facebook page at DGS Coins, at DGS Coins. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we do have a Facebook page.
Yes.
But Dave, your weekly blog that came out on Saturday featured an update on the Fed's extended operations in the repo market. One particular interest was how that is affecting money supply. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. Melody, as we know, large corporations and banks typically hold vast quantities of cash and other types of highly liquid financial assets. So they like using these things called repurchase agreements as a way of quick and easy financing. We talked about repos and what they are and how they work 2 weeks ago, also in one of our articles, so we won't rehash that, but there are more than $1 trillion worth of overnight repo transactions collateralized with U.S. government debt occurring every day. You know, banks frequently go to these markets to fund the loans they issue and to finance the trades they execute. And that's when it's working smoothly. Now, when the repo market imploded last month, median repurchase rates skyrocketed from their usual range, the Fed funds rate at the time, 2 to 2.25%, to 2.46% on that Monday and 5.25% the next day. Some repo rates, in fact, were as high as 9%, roughly four times the Fed's own target rate at the time. You know, the Fed usually puts a cap on how high Treasury repo rates can climb. Well, an unlucky convergence of events, including an unusually large demand for cash, you know, that coming from U.S. companies that needed to pay their tax bills, that sucked a lot of the available cash out of the financial markets. What happened, you know, any counterparty that needed cash and only held collateral like treasuries, you know, they agreed to pay the much higher going repo rates, that is, you know, 2.46, 5.25, 9% even. Now, that's simple supply and demand, and it really mirrors what happened in a lot of the repo markets in 2007, right before the housing crash, and of course, the Great Recession that followed.
Yeah, when you get these kind of reactions in these markets and that money supply, I mean, it's not normal. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something wrong. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about this when we come back. We're going to look at what happened to the usual pile of cash and liquid securities that powers this $1 trillion repo market. $1 trillion a night seems like a lot of money, Dave.
Well, it does seem like a lot. It, I guess when you think of the whole scheme of things, however, especially because of newer post-crisis reserve requirements that the government imposes on banks, yeah, and then I mean, you see in the totality of the whole economy, it's certainly impressive, but I think, you know, it's probably not a big surprise.
And I hear the music that's telling us we're heading into a break, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, and we'll talk to you in just a few minutes. Would you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
The Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And of course, these radio programs are archived every day, every week, every month, every year. And of course, you can listen live at 4 o'clock Eastern Time, right at, on the radio page. Just go to the top. There's a bar. Click it on, and you will hear us live. Heading into the break, we were talking about Dave's article and, you know, what is going on with these the money supply and with what's going on with the repo market and everything. And, you know, so the question is, what happened to the usual pile of cash and liquid securities that powers this trillion-dollar repo market, Dave?
Well, it's been slowly evaporating, in a nutshell, actually for some time, or at least, you know, since the Fed ended QE, quantitative easing, 5 years ago. You know, the thinking and hope of that controversial policy was, you know, that the increased liquidity in the markets would encourage banks to lend more, you know, and that in turn would spur economic growth, you know, at the bottom of the downturn. And those kinds of accommodative actions have been over for some time now, and at least officially, and total bank reserves have steadily been decreasing. They peaked in mid-2014, as a matter of fact, and you know, are now closer to where the reserves were in 2011. And one of the big reasons for that is the high level of government debt issued over the past 4 years, which has literally sucked reserves out of the financial system. You know, when a squeeze like the one last month occurs, it's a clear indicator that there aren't enough reserves in the financial system for the repo markets to clear at the Fed's preferred level, that is, the Fed funds rate. And that, in theory anyway, explains why the Fed's been getting its hands dirty the last couple of weeks to inject reserves back into the banking system through overnight purchases of treasuries.
Dave, tell the listeners what money supply is, please.
Oh, well, you know, in a nutshell, it's a snapshot. It's a snapshot of the entire stock of currency and other liquid instruments that are circulating in, you know, this or any other economy. The Fed, especially, economists as a whole, see the money supply as an important tool for understanding the larger economy, and especially for guiding macroeconomic policy. And because of the relationship between money and inflation and interest rates. And here's an example. An increase in the money supply typically lowers interest rates, which in turn generates more investment and puts more money in the hands of consumers, thereby stimulating spending, which in turn can, over time, raise inflation. Businesses respond by this, you know, additional spending by ordering more raw materials, increasing production. Of course, the increased business activity theoretically raises the demand for labor. Now, the opposite can occur too if the money supply falls or when its growth rate declines. Money supply is broken up into several different categories of liquidity, or they call it spendability. M0 and M1, for example, includes coins, not gold and silver, and notes that are in circulation and other money equivalents that can be converted easily to cash. M2, which is the key here, and includes M1 plus short-term time deposits in bank savings account, repos, and certain money market funds. And MZM, which you hardly hear about, money zero maturity, that's a measure that includes financial assets with zero maturity and are immediately redeemable at their stated level or par. Now, the Fed relies heavily on MZM data because its velocity, I was thinking of Jurassic Park there and velociraptors, its velocity, you know, which is the rate, you know, which money changes hands between businesses and consumers, is considered a reliable indicator of inflation. Now, in terms of the U.S. money supply, the M2 money supply dropped from $15.051 trillion in the week ending September 6 to $14.984 in the week ending September 23rd. And after the Fed's repo actions, it rose again to $15.070 in the week ending September 30th. There's a lot more we could cover, but look, the bottom line here, Melody, the repo issue, you know, much less rising uncertainty over its impacts on inflation and interest rates, isn't just yet over. Alexandra Saidi of Fortune magazine says, as plumbing problems go, this will be an expensive one to sort out.
Very interesting. So, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you sign up, get our newsletter and our blog, dgscoins.com. Just go to the little mailbox and click on and give us your info. And we don't send out daily mail to you. We're not one of those firms. We send you information that we think is important and necessary for you to know about. So that's dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. There's a Salesforce CEO, Marc Benioff, calls for new capitalism. What's that about, Dave? He's calling for the establishment of a new capitalism?
Yeah, this, he wrote an op. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No,
go ahead.
He wrote an op-ed. Marc Benioff, who's the co-CEO of the company Salesforce, software company, calling for the establishment of a new capitalism that, interestingly, is paid for in part by taxing billionaires like himself. This op-ed was published, mainstream media now, New York Times, today. Benioff said businesses should focus less on profits and more on their impact on society while using their power to help advance important causes like the creation of a national privacy law, things like that. To achieve these goals, he proposed a new system that includes higher taxes on the wealthiest among us, quote unquote. Nationally, he wrote, increasing taxes on high-income individuals like myself, him, not me, ladies and gentlemen, would help generate the trillions of dollars that we desperately need to improve education and health care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. Thank you. But you know what the problem is, Dave, when I have issues with all these so-called billionaires who say, hey, tax us, tax us, tax us. They have the ability and so many loopholes and everything else, they will never be affected by those laws that they encourage to write. The only ones who really become affected, because just like he says, oh, they want to create more of a larger national privacy law, you know, it's just... And I even heard, was it, it was the gentleman, I think, that Home Depot was one of the original, I can't recall his name.
Their CEO?
Yeah.
Yeah, I forget him, too.
But that's and I'm pretty sure that's what he said. He says it was like, you know, you can tax us all you want, but we're wealthy, we're rich enough that we can find all the loopholes that you ever need for us to avoid it. So then who does it really trickle down to? They don't make legislation to hurt the wealthy. You know, it doesn't work that way. It won't work that way. It will never work that way. And
well,
that's
look,
the problem.
Look, I'm not, I haven't thought this through enough yet, and I certainly can't say I support it, but and I'm not passing judgment on it, but I do think his comments are a good reason why I think in the next 10 years there will be something along the line of a wealth tax, not an income tax, which, as you said, allows the rich to avoid through loopholes, but a wealth tax that taxes net worth. And it's highly controversial, as we know. Even the wealthy people who support higher income taxes don't really support this net worth tax. But I think that could be something in the future, particularly as our debt gets bigger and other options, you know, become less politically viable.
But the thing of it is, there is the estate tax. You are taxing the wealthy for their you are taxing them already.
Well, after a
it's called the estate tax.
After a $10 million exemption.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers that they talk about are up that high anyway. And you lower it, then you have the, you know, then you lower it too low and so forth. But the thing of it is, they're not, in the world we live in today, all of a sudden they're going to want to support this. They've already left this country. That's not going to make them bring back their manufacturing. That's not going to make them, taxing them more is not going to make them bring back and create more jobs for this country so that people can have a great wage and so forth. You know, they can bring back the jobs, but it still has to be competitive. So, I mean, how do you fix the health care? You got to take the corruption and everything. So you could tax all you want, but until you fix what the real problem is, nothing will work.
Yeah, well, I hear you. But I think you could just as easily argue that while you know, there's certainly an abundance of fraud, waste, and abuse in government and corporations, you know, there is room for additional tax at the higher income levels. And this, you know, our needs aren't going to be particularly in healthcare in the coming, you know, in the coming generation, with all of us baby boomers retiring, and with, you know, the health insurance trust fund, the Medicare trust funds, you know, starting to get low on money. They're going to run out. It's not going to go down to zero, but, you know, they're not going to be enough money to pay current benefits in, you know, less than 10 years. It's going to take a combination of spending cuts or benefit cuts, which no one has an appetite for,
right,
and revenue increases.
And that's just it, Dave. You just can't increase, you know, taxes, I don't care who you, without doing something in the opposite direction. And they don't have the cojones in D.C. to do anything, because that's, you know, it's a vicious circle.
Old people vote. Now, you're right.
You know, vote. Who do we have to vote for?
Well, until we reform our governmental system, we've talked about this for a couple of years now, be it term limits, which I think is key. Some people think it's an imposition on freedom of speech, you know, not be able to choose who you really, you know, want as your representative. Well, you can. It's just that, you know, like many governors, like our president, you know, members of Congress have fixed terms, period. And they should. And that, you know, I think in concert with substantial campaign finance reform, which is no doubt going to have to be driven from the ground up because they're so self-interested, our elected officials, it ain't going to happen at that level. Until that happens, we're going to be in this vicious, vicious cycle. And it's, you know, it's like it's like a tornado, you know, it's swirling and swirling, but on a downward, you know, trend, and it's just going to get worse and worse until it just explodes.
And that's what I believe is going to happen. You can't fix anything, no matter what you do, until it explodes, because it's not going to get fixed from the inside. It's just not going to happen. And I don't care who you have in office, the swamp is not going to be drained, and until it is forced to be drained. And you know, everybody can, you know, think that it can be, but it won't be. things can't get better until they start, until you clean it out. And it's our financial system, our healthcare system. I mean, it's just everything. They have totally destroyed the inner workings, I guess, of you know, and you know, you follow the money, so you look at our financial system and look at the problems we have. And everybody says, well, you know, everything just seems to be going along just fine, so we don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, that's, as we know, is corporate-run media.
Yes, exactly.
And, well,
even when you're diagnosed with, I don't like to use this, you know, even if you're diagnosed with a bad disease or something, you still have good days. So
that's a good analogy. Well, what do we do? I mean, all I think to say it, you know, after all of this is to say to my children's generation and to their children's, hey, sorry, we've fallen terribly short. We've created quite the storm for you and your generations to try and make things better.
That's exactly what we've done. And we're out of time, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you, Dave. Great program. And until then, tomorrow we'll be back. Be safe, good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye.
There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.